The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. Round one tests their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meanings of the following words right. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is pedagogy, or some people occasionally who use this word say pedagogy. Pedagogy, pedagogy.
Do they? Concerned with teaching.
Yes, and how concerned with teaching?
Teaching in a rather pedagogic way.
You're not being very helpful.
Well, a rather pedantic way.
No, this isn't quite right, you know. A pedagogue is like that, yes, I agree. That's a rather critical word,
yes,
about a teacher, but pedagogy is not quite the same. It's the science of teaching, if that exists. Dennis Norden, the meaning of the word impasto, I-M-P-A-S-T-O, impasto.
Well, it's a term used in painting.
Yes.
It's using great, dirty great dollops of paint.
Yes.
Oodles and tons of paint. Great thick scoops of paint. And the chief exponents of the school were the people who did my house.
Well, Dennis, I haven't seen your house since it was painted, but you're quite right, and that's 2 marks. It means laying on of colour thickly, putting it on a thick coating. So, to Anne Scott-James, Anne, what is a lamia? L-A-M-I-A.
Lamia. Oh, there was a very sinister poem by Keats called,
yes,
Lamia. It's a woman with serpentine nature, half woman, half serpent.
And what's she do?
Oh, she bewitches.
Yes. It is a monster with the head and breast of a woman and the body and tail of a serpent who preys on human beings and sucks the blood of children. Frank Muir, what is Percy? P-U-R-S-Y. An adjective.
A rotten word. I wasn't expecting a rotten word. Expecting a nice word. I know what a Charlie is. But a Percy. Persiflage. Purse-like, presumably.
Yes, that's impossible.
To purse your lips is, yeah, to pucker them, as with drawing the mouth of a leathern purse together with the drawstring.
I've got to give you marks there. You're home and dry with one of the two meanings, and I think because it is a perfectly good dictionary meaning, which is, as you say, puckered like the mouth of the kind of purse which you once used to have, where you drew the mouth together with string. Okay. But there is another reason, a meaning for it, and
that
is a short-winded, puffy, corpulent man, a pursy little man. That's the other meaning. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down if they want, and I want the two women members of the team to go on studying their quotations, and then at the end of the programme I shall ask them for the source of those particular quotations. So, Anne Scott-James and Dennis Norden, here's your quotation. Yon solitary highland lass. And Dillis and Frank Muir, yours is, tell me, where is fancy bread? And then at the end of the programme, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written. And so to round two, and this is a round of Shakespeare questions. For 2 marks, who and in which play by Shakespeare was which character referred to as follows? Dillis Powell, who died Babylon of Green Fields?
Falstaff.
Do you remember who said so?
widow something?
Yes.
Quickly.
Mistress Quickly.
Mistress.
Talking about Falstaff's death in King Henry V, as it happens, he died as it had been any Christum child, babbling a green field, and his nose was as sharp as a pen. Two marks. Dennis Norton, who was a fellow of the strangest mind in the world?
Is it I Delight in Masks and... Yes.
Yes.
It's Andrew Agouti.
Well done. This is a very difficult one.
Delight in Masks and Revels, and he eats a lot of roast beef.
That's him. It's Sir Andrew Agouti in Twelfth Night, boasting about himself, spurred on by Sir Toby, and he says, following this, I am a fellow of the strangest mind in the world. I delight in masks and revels, sometimes altogether. And Toby goes on spurring him, says, is this a world to hide virtue in? He's trying to push him on to court Olivia. Two marks, well done, Dennis. Rather different one for you, Anne Scott James.
No.
You yourself are much condemned to have an itching palm, to sell and mart your offices for gold to undeservers.
Mm. Is it the obvious one with an itching palm? No, you say it's difficult.
No, I think not the most obvious one. It's a fairly well-known quarrel scene. A high Roman manor.
Julius Caesar.
Half a mark for Julius Caesar. It's when the conspirators start quarrelling with each other after the death of Caesar and just before the Battle of Philippi. It's Brutus attacking Cassius because he's been accused of feathering his own nest before the battle, and it's in the quarrel scene just before they both get killed. Now, Frank Muir. I know your patience well. That same cowardly, giant-like oxbeef hath devoured many a gentleman of your house. I promise you, your kindred hath made mine eyes water ere now.
Bottom?
Yes.
Oh, it's A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes.
Jack, one mark. By William Shakespeare, two marks.
Only one so far, unless you tell me the character that Bottom is addressing.
Is it Moth, Cobweb,
yes.
Peace Blossom, or Mustard Seed?
And you're dead right. It's one of Titania's attendant fairies in the Midsummer Night's Dream, after Bottom has had this ass's head put over his ears, and they're fanning him, and when he meets Mustard Seed, this is what he says in this rather ponderous, jocular manner. Two marks. Well, the next round is poetry and verse. I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them for the following line or lines. They get two marks if they can complete the quotation and two more for correctly naming its source. Beginning again with Dulles Powell. She found me roots of relish sweet and honey wild and manna dew, and sure in language strange, she said,
that's your supper and so to bed.
Rhyming the wrong line.
Oh.
And honey wild and manna dew.
It's Keats, the Belle Dame sans Merci.
Quite right.
Yes.
She found me roots of relish sweet and honey wild and manna dew, and sure in language strange she said, I love thee true. Dennis Norden. Day after day, day after day, we stuck nor breath nor motion.
Something like a painted ship upon a painted ocean.
Yes, and?
The Ancient Mariner
by
Coleridge.
Quite right. Day after day, day after day, we stuck nor breath nor motion, as idle as a painted ship upon a painted ocean. Coleridge's Ancient Mariner, just about the point when they said, water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink. Anne Scott James. She lived unknown, and few could know when Lucy ceased to be, but she is in her grave, and oh.
The difference to me.
Yes.
Lucy Gray.
No.
Not quite.
It's not called that.
Something like that, isn't it?
It's.
What is it called?
She dwelt among untrodden ways beside the springs of Dove, where there was something few to praise and something not
to love. Yeah.
Absolutely right. It's got the whole thing. This is Wordsworth. It is about Lucy, and probably the same Lucy as Lucy Gray, which is another poem. And it's called She Dwelt Among Untrodden Ways, and it goes, as you've just heard, but she is in her grave, and oh, the difference to me. Well done. Now, Frank Muir. A reeling road, a rolling road that rambles round the shire, and after him the parson ran, the sexton and the squire. A merry road, a mazy road, and such as we did tread.
The night we went to Golders Green by way of Birkenhead.
It's nearly right, but it does in fact end another stanza.
This is before the Roman came to Rye or crossed a Severn Strode.
Yes.
The rolling English drunkard made the rolling English road.
And by?
Well, it's by, just by Puppet Bar. by Gilbert Keith Chesterton.
Yeah.
And the night we went to Birmingham by way of Beachy Head.
That's the one I wanted. Yeah. 4 marks it is. Well done. The next round is a bit of a quickie round. In what work, by what writer, do these characters appear? Tilispao, Dulcinea del Toboso.
Don Quixote.
And who was she?
She was really a kind of servant maid, but she was always regarded in his fantasies by Don Quixote as a splendid, noble lady.
That's absolutely right. She was the village wench. Whom Don Quixote did all his knightly deeds for, and she was completely unaware that this was all happening. In Cervantes' Don Quixote. 2 marks. Dennis Norden. Felix Leiter. L-E-I-T-E-R.
Yes. He was in Goldfinger.
Yes?
Yes, he's the James Bond's American mate, American pal. Played in the film by Cece Linder.
Elder. 2 marks. He's an American secret agent. He worked first for the FBI, and then he had a brush with some sharks and lost legs and things, and I think then had to work for Pinkertons. But he was always working with James Bond as long as James Bond went on working. 2 marks. Anne Scott James. Dora Spenlow and Agnes Wickfield.
Oh, they were the wives of David Copperfield.
Well, not all at the same time.
No, well, of course not. One after the other. And Dora died in extremely mawkish circumstances.
That's
and
right.
Agnes took over.
Absolutely right. They were the successive wives of David Copperfield in Dickens' book of the same name. 2 marks. Frank Muir. Lady Snarewell.
Lady Snarewell was a bitchy gossip.
Yes. She
comes
was.
Comes into Act One, Scene One. The School for Scandal, Richard Brinsley Sheridan, published first in Dublin in 1779.
Well, Frank, if I give you a bonus mark, I would, but it's not allowed by the rules. 2 marks it is. Well, now we have again a quick round of what are called nouns of assembly. First of all, Dillispower, an assembly of nightingales.
An awakening of nightingales.
A half mark. It's a watch. Dennis Norden, assembly of snipe.
Whisper snipe.
Whisper
yes.
snipe.
A whisper of snipe.
Yes.
All right. Anne Scott James, monkeys.
Wagon load.
Oh, yes. Thanks so much for helping.
So. Wagon load of monkeys.
This is really quite easy, this one.
A troop of monkeys.
It is. It's a troop of monkeys. And Frank Muir, yours is quails.
A school of quails. That's Wales.
No,
Antony of...
Mm. It's almost what an ex-captain of Wolverhampton Wanderers and England married.
Could married be. A Beverly sister.
Yeah. Yes.
A bevy.
That's it.
A bevy of quails.
It's a bevy of quails. And now we come to the last round, and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier on in the programme. For 2 marks, Anne Scott James, I'd like the origin of your quotation, Yon Solitary Highland Lass.
Well, I think you've shot this poet at me before this evening. It's Wordsworth.
Yes.
I haven't got to say what comes after it, have I? I've answered it now, have I?
That's, you've answered it. If you would like to say what comes after it, just save me doing it.
No, you do it.
It's the Highland Reaper, Wordsworth. Behold her silent in the field, yon solitary highland lass. Dumont. Joseph Powell, the origin of your quotation now. Tell me, where is fancy bred?
It's Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And it's The Merchant of Venice.
Yes. 2 marks. Well, now I ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back first to Dennis Norden with his quotation, yon solitary highland lass.
Frank has seen fit to make reference tonight to Golders Green, which is the place where I exist. Because I am known locally as the outcast of Golders Green. And former friends twitch at their curtains and say, there he goes, the man who disgraced himself at Thora Tidmarsh's party. Now, it honestly wasn't my fault. I just didn't know. I honestly didn't know. I had never even seen one. I didn't even know that women had them. And I have there may be men here who... Have you seen a false eyelash? There must... Have you... A naked false eyelash? You know what I mean? Sort of detached from its wearer. These things are around, and I didn't know. But you see, when the invitation came, I was so excited. On the invitation, it said 7:30 for 8, and I drew up sharp outside the house there, 7:30. I didn't actually get in the house till 9:45, because I'd bought this second-hand safety belt. You know, they keep on about it. I thought, well, I'll get one, but I don't spend money on a new one. The catch had slipped round to the back. And I had to do this kind of Houdini thing. It's terribly awkward when you're trapped in there, and you have to sort of undo something behind your back. So I arrived there rather dishevelled. It was commented that I looked dishevelled, and, oh, Mr. Tidmarsh said, perhaps you'd like to go upstairs and tidy up your dishevelment a bit. And I said, yes. And he said, well, go up to Thora's bedroom, which I went into, which is a very sort of feminine kind of room. She's a sort of elderly feminine lady, and this was all sort of lilac and gold, and the bedhead was quilted with buttons and things on it, and had one of those protective, transparent plastic over it, you know. It always makes me think, hello, does the rain come in then? You know. And it was very dark in there, just these two lamps on the dressing table, at which was seated one of the dishiest-looking girls I have ever... She was sort of doing running repairs to her face, you know. And I brightened up immediately, you know, and said, good evening. And she made that noise that women make when they're putting on lipstick, you know. And I thought, this is going to be all right, this party. And I went over to the other mirror to tidy my dishevelment up. And there, suddenly, as I looked back at her, I saw it. On the glass top of the dressing table, this thing that looked like a hairy spider. Just sort of arched and curving by her left hand. I went cold. You know, it's such a horrible looking. And I said, don't move. Don't move a muscle. See, and she froze. She froze, and very quietly, I took off my shoe, and I strode over, and bash, I brought it down as hard as I could upon this obscene-looking insect. Of course, the glass tabletop crashed and broke immediately. The mirror went over. 3 bottles of perfume went on the floor. And the insect thing went on the floor with it, and I leapt after it, leaping on top of it and banging at it with the heel of my shoe. And I was quivering, you know, that terrible feeling of this loathsome thing. And I hit it and hit it till it went quite flat. And I was all panting, and I turned around, and I said, I think it's going to be all right now. I think that got it. And it was only then, as she looked at me with a kind of rigid horror, that I noticed Only then that one of her eyes looked somehow shorter than the other. And was at that moment of realisation that the door suddenly burst open and there was Thora Tidmarsh with all the guests behind them. Thora Tidmarsh saying, "What was the noise? What was that crash? We heard a..." And she broke off as she saw the scene. Me standing there, all dishevelled, with one shoe up in the air, quivering, panting, debris everywhere, and this girl at the dressing table shrinking back in horror. Thora Tidmarsh said, "Mr. Norton, I think you'd better leave my house. We don't countenance that sort of behaviour in Gold is Green." And all the guests behind her sort of silently parted and made way for me, and their eyes went all sort of cold with loathing. And I went, you know, because I immediately figured it out, you know, what is it best to be shunned for? Be shunned as being a cad and a lecher, or as a man who leaps full length upon a false nylon eyelash? So I made my choice, and that's what made me an outcast. And as I bent to put my shoe on, I caught a glimpse of this thing on the floor there, and I thought, strange. I bet there's nothing ever been a stranger instrument of a man's social downfall than yon solitary nylon lash.
Well, I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm in tears. We've got to pass on quickly to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "Tell me, where is fancy bread?"
Right, sit up straight, will you? Now, quiet, quiet. Have no chatter. Shoulders back. During this history period, I'm going to tell you about Egypt 100 to 200 years B.C., Now, in Egypt at that time, you had the Ptolemy dynasty, very interesting dynasty. They were founded many centuries before by the first Ptolemy, who was a general of Alexander the Great. Anybody know which date? Anybody? No? Longland?
334.
You wish something? 334?
334.
Very good, boy. And you may. But don't be too long. And sharpen it away from you. Ptolemy was one of... Ptolemy was one of Alexander's generals. And he settled in Egypt, town of Alexander, named it after his emperor, then usurped him and founded this dynasty. I'm really concerned, I want to tell you about Ptolemy the Fifth. Ptolemy the Fifth and his wife, Cleopatra the First. Ptolemy 5, Cleopatra 1. Now, we know quite a lot about this period. Ptolemies were a very liberal dynasty. They built the first library in Alexandria. Realized that books were stone those times. But he married Cleopatra the First in the year 160 BC. Now, interesting thing is, we know quite a lot about this ceremony because it was recorded in a thing called the Rosetta Stone, which you can see at the British Museum. What we've never known is what he wore at his wedding. That is never recorded. But I have found out. I have found out with the aid of a plastic magnifying glass from a breakfast food packet. You see, we know that the kings of Egypt normally had three togas, ceremonial togas. They had a sort of blue denim one for supervising pyramid building. Then they had a white one, heavily embroidered in gold braid with seed pearls. which they used for rather fancy occasions, cocktail parties and so forth. And they had, of course, for the Senate, the simple purple number. Which of those did Ptolemy wear at his wedding? That we've never known. Now, I went to the British Museum, I saw the Rosetta Stone, and I discovered that on the back of it, what was taken to be merely bumps, I have discovered, is actually journalese, and it describes the wedding of King Ptolemy and Cleopatra I. And, boys, I know what the king wore, which of his togas he wore at his wedding. And I'll tell you now. Ptolemy wore his fancy braid.
Well, even H.G. Wells only dared give us an outline of history. And that brings us to a final score in which Dennis wins the competition of the two stories, and to a final score in which Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden win by 2.5 marks from Dennis Powell and Frank Muir. And it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.